Good evening and welcome to a live telephone town hall meeting with your 24th District lawmakers. This is a live event. Press star 3 at any time, right now or whenever, to ask a question of your lawmakers. I'm going to pass it on now to Senator Kevin Vandeweghe, Representative Steve Theringer, and Representative Mike Chapman for opening remarks. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Guy. This is Kevin Vandeweghe, your state senator. I'll start by kicking it off. And thanks, everybody, for joining tonight. It's a beautiful evening out, and we appreciate the time that you take to listen to us and ask us questions about the legislative session that just wrapped up. Just as a quick reminder, we represent the 24th Legislative District, which is the entire Olympic Peninsula. It covers the northern half of Grays Harbor, Montesano, Hoquiam, some of Aberdeen now, Ocean Shores North, all of Clallam, and all of Jefferson County, about 170,000 people. And we represent you, the state capitol in Olympia, and do a session every year. We do long sessions where we pass a large budget. That was last year. This is a supplemental year, so it's smaller on everything, and it's just a 60-day session and 60 straight days. So we're just wrapped that up. I personally worked on some legislation around wildland codes to try to prevent houses from burning down in the state. A lot of people might remember in 2023, about 250 houses burned down in the state during wildfires. We are in the process of updating a code. So in very wildfire-prone areas, future homes will be built more fire-resistant, which is good for the homeowners and good for the state. Also worked on some legislation around biochar. We see a lot of logging slash piles burned, and we're working to see if we can get a lot of that slash into some valuable biochar. It's better for the environment than just open burning, and biochar is a great like water additive slash fertilizer. One other bill I did was to give 911 operators binding arbitration. I, of course, am a firefighter paramedic in Squim, and I rely heavily on our 911 operators. They work in a system where they don't have binding arbitration, nor, of course, do they have the right to strike. So this hopefully will make their bargaining and lives easier moving forward. And then the last one I'll mention, a lot of people realize, especially if you've been here to the Capitol campus in Olympia, we have a very beautiful one, probably one of the more beautiful Capitol campuses for state capitals in the nation. And there are a lot of memorials and plaques and structures on the Capitol campus to remember a lot of folks. But there is not one for firefighters. And so this year we passed legislation. And Representative Theringer worked in his capital budget to fund it, legislation to start a firefighter memorial. So that personally to me is important. That kind of wraps up the legislation I worked on, and I'll let Steve talk some.
Thanks, Kevin. Good evening, everybody. Thanks for joining us. And like Kevin said, it's kind of a nice night, so there might be folks that are out in their yard listening. So as folks know, you know, I live in Port Townsend, representing the 24th, along with Kevin and Mike. And major part of my work and session is to work on the capital budget because I chair that committee in the House. And we had a robust capital budget this year, about $1.2 billion, actually, which is really a very robust number for a second year in the biennium. And a lot of that, about $700 million of it, came from the Climate Commitment Act accounts that comes out of the CCA legislation. And then another $300 million of it or so came from the Common School Construction Fund, which is the amount of dollars that come in above $500 million from the capital gains funding. So we were able to use those funds to spread across the state investments in an HVAC for schools, forest, trust land transfer, and other forest protection things, and then a number of salmon recovery and estuary restoration efforts that were really key to that were based on that funding. The other areas where we were able to do some things I think that were important is dealing with early learning and daycare. In our district, we funded a facility down in Montesano, the site preparation in Montesano, and some money for the Shore Pool in Port Angeles to help them expand their daycare, and then also a early learning center in Port Angeles affiliated with the Y. The other issue that I think everyone is concerned about, certainly statewide, is behavioral health and the opioid pandemic and those issues. And so we had robust funding in this budget of about $80 million to fund a number of clinics around the state. The two that were stood out in our district was to finish off the Jamestown Slalom Behavioral Health Center and SQIM. They're going to expand a 16-bed facility there, which is sorely needed in the North Peninsula. And then the Quinault Nation down in Aberdeen is also expanding their facility there, and we were able to get them about $7.8 million to do that. I will highlight, I think, in the north part of the district up in SQIM was $5 million to be able to fund a center of excellence or a career and technical center that will really focus on carpentry, and they'll partner with the Habitat program that's building 54 houses just almost across the street from the school in SQIM, and that's the type of relationships we like to develop to have, you know, the carpentry skills being developed in the high school, and then they go out and work on the Habitat humanity housing. And there's a number of skill centers and centers of excellence around the state that are doing that. So we think that's going to be a bright piece for SQIM and for developing those construction skills on the peninsula. A couple other things were an HVAC system that we funded for Quilicine. They needed a new heating and air system, so we were able to do that. And then there's a couple of planning grants for Chimicum and North Beach for our schools around the district. So I think a lot of good things in this budget. Some of it is dependent on the Climate Commitment Act and the capital gains tax, so some of that is qualified. We have to wait to see what happens with those initiatives in November, and then the budget has got language in it that sort of qualifies that as the caveat for not being able to spend that if those pass. So I think it was a good session, and we were able to do some good investing in the 24th district. And I'll turn it over to Mike. Really looking forward to getting your questions. That's probably the best part of this whole evening.
Yeah, thanks, Steve and Kevin. Just as Representative Chapman, I live in Port Angeles. I just want to put on the record that it's always been an honor to serve with both Steve and Kevin. And I think the three of us, we don't always agree on every issue, but we certainly talk about what's best for the district. And I think that when we work on budgets and legislation and the pieces of legislation that Kevin talked about and the budget information that Steve talked about, you know, we've all got input and we're trying to do the very best for the district. And I think it's important that you have three folks that are working hard and that we communicate, gosh, on a really regular, you know, Steve and I see each other every day, of course, on the House, but even with Senator Vandaway, we have meetings and touch base. So working in the transportation budget, obviously there's a lot of questions and concerns, but a couple of things that's important, and I think the Seattle Times this week ran an editorial on some of the fish passage barrier projects. We're trying to, you know, prioritize those projects, but one of the things that folks also need to realize is that we're making those crossings not just better for fish passage, but also more resilient, and I feel like that never gets talked about. So you take these old culverts out, which in an earthquake or floods, you know, they can wash out and the road could potentially collapse. Now we're going to have really good structures that are much more able to withstand higher river flows when we have the floods, earthquakes, and other things that, you know, we live on the North Olympic Peninsula. The weather's always dealing us a challenge here and there. So I think when people are, like, I understand people get pretty frustrated sitting in traffic, but I think the contractors, the recent round of projects, it seems like they're figuring out how to keep traffic flowing. But remember, we're also trying to make these roadways a lot more resilient to the floods and earthquakes that we're prone to. So if everyone, we're going to work through it. We're getting there. And I just would hope that everyone would be a little more patient. Finally, for those of us who live on the north end of the district, but even if you come up from Hoquiam up north, you'll see a brand new bridge being built over the Elwha River. And folks, remember a number of years ago, my first year in the legislature, I was able to secure the $30+ million to build a brand new bridge. The former bridge was not built on bedrock. And so with the dams being removed and high water flows, it was really clear that that bridge was at danger of being, washed away in a major flood event. It's really gratifying to see the work, the men and women working hard in those new girders and the new bridge deck being built, and really grateful that we were able to move that project. It took a little longer. And then I'm sure there'll be questions on ferries. I'll wait and see what people's specific questions are on the ferry system. Rest assured, many of us have worked pretty tirelessly on that issue. There's no easy answer, but there are some good solutions that I think we're working on. So with that, I think our moderator tonight is Guy. I think he can take over from here to help moderate this town hall.
Thank you so much, all of you. If you're listening, this is a live telephone town hall meeting with your 24th district lawmakers. Press *3 on your phone right now or at any time during this call, *3, to ask your question of the 24th district lawmakers. We actually have a related question to what Representative Chapman just talked about. Ed is asking about a highway project, Highway 112. Ed, go ahead. You're live.
Hey, representatives and Senator, Ed Bowen up here in the corner of the district. Hey, you got us $9.8 million to work on Highway 112, 0 through 41 milepost. But after a year, it looks like they're going to put, I'll just say, the vast majority of those funds towards the first 8 miles, which are very much needed. So my question for any one of the three of you, I don't think this was addressed during the short session, but what's the plan for those remaining 33 miles? Do we look forward to some additional particular issues in the 33 miles being addressed through appropriations? Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ed. Good to hear from you again. Ed's always done a great job of keeping us focused on the West End, both when Steve and I were county commissioners, but certainly those of us as we're in the Olympia. You're right. With the rest of the road needs a significant investment, working with the Macaw and trying to see if we can get some help from the federal government. But we did not have new projects funded this in the short session. We didn't have a new revenue source, but I believe that's top of the priority to see see what the next stretch of highway can be improved in the biennial budget next year, and then also continuing to work with the Macaw Nation and currently Congressman Kilmer's office, but we'll have a new congressperson next year to see if we can get some help out of the federal government. But at the end of the day, that is a highway. For those who know that, I mean, it's basically, it wants to move toward the water. So it's constantly experiencing washouts. And for the Macaw Nation, it's obviously, it's a huge, huge issue for them, as they literally do live on the northwest tip of the continental United States. So glad to get the first once we get these projects going, it becomes easier to get the next round of funding. So let's get these first few miles taken care of, and then we'll work on the next round of funding in the next biennial budget. So great question. Glad you're keeping that front and center for me. Get your emails all the time and appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Representative Chapman, and thank you, Ed. Press *3 on your phone to ask your question of your local 24th district lawmakers. Press it now or press it anytime during this call. We now have a live question from Michael about school lunches and school meals. Michael, go ahead. You're live.
Yes, hello. I'm Michael from Port Ludlow. I'm interested in free breakfast and lunch for all school kids. I know there are currently some restrictions and some coverage. Are there any plans to remove all restrictions so we can cover all school children with no restrictions?
Ed,
guess I could take that one, and Mike or Kevin can pipe in. I think it's a budget issue, quite frankly, trying to fund them. I think the three of us think it's the right thing to do, because it's pretty obvious that if the kids are hungry, they're not going to be learning. So I think that, it's just trying to find the dollars to do that. Anytime you touch K-12, it gets pretty expensive. Just an example, to provide half a counselor for all the schools costs about $300 million. So if you can imagine providing meals before the bell, breakfast, and then lunch, it gets kind of pricey. But I think that's a goal for us to try to get to that within the budget.
Thank you so much for that question and that answer. We are a live telephone town hall in the 24th District. Press *3 on your phone right now to ask a question of your local lawmakers. We now have a question from Bruce about schools not being ready for earthquakes. Bruce, go ahead. You're live.
Oh, just I understand that the schools in Squim, Port Angeles haven't been earthquake-proofed for, a really large earthquake, and wondering if there's any plans for that.
Yeah, so we're in the capital budget. We've been working over the last 4 years or so to deal with the seismic conditions for schools. In that process, we use the Department of Natural Resources, Geologic Department, to provide maps and testing of where schools are on fault. So if those are the highest priority schools that we've been addressing, trying to go out and find out, where those two overlap, and then the construction, if it's an old, brick and mortar construction, they're the highest priority. And we've funded over the last two biennium, I think around $120 million to do that. That money has not quite gotten out the door. It's a challenge to, one, do that research and find that data, and then secondly, for the schools to adjust to that. But it's certainly on our screen. We're going to be working over the interim just in general to look at the way the state funds school construction, because our formula, the school, what's called SCAP, the School Construction Assistance Program, is outdated. It's based on square footage, for example, that doesn't even include hallways or meeting spaces. It's just the classrooms. And the amount of money the state puts in doesn't really cover the true cost. So that's sort of the interim work between now and next year to really address, see if we can come up with a formula and a better process to fund schools just in general. And I'm hoping that Port Angeles and Squim will be part of that. For example, one idea is we'd go to a sort of a capital asset model where we have a prototypical type school construction model that districts could access maybe out of cross-laminated timber, and that would drive costs down across the state if we had this standardized approach to construction. So a lot of work to be done in the area of school construction.
Thank you so much, Representative Therringer, and thank you for that question. We now have a question from Susan about the drug crisis, but if you're listening to this is a live telephone town hall meeting. Press *3 on your phone right now or anytime to ask your question of your local 24th district lawmakers. Susan, go ahead, you're live.
Hello, my name is Susan. I live in Port Angeles and in central Port Angeles, and I've seen firsthand the devastation of the drug crisis here get worse each year. In fact, we have one of the highest overdose rates in the state in Collin County. And I see many failures in the harm reduction system as currently practiced. So my question is, what are you going to do to get more accountability and hard data from all these different methods that you're funding, primarily what is so-called harm reduction, I believe needs to be radically reevaluated and held accountable and to be more, what are you going to do to be more recovery focused and choosing how you spend dollars?
It's a good question, Susan. This is Kevin, and like Mike, I live in Port Angeles. I live in rural Port Angeles. So, but I understand clearly what you're talking about. I think it's something that's frustrating and worrisome to us all. and it only seems to get worse. I mean, just a few years ago, we thought, you know, we'd never see an end to meth, and now fentanyl is kind of sweeping our state and nation and causing a lot of people to struggle. And you're right, when we invest in programs like this, we do need to make sure that the money is being spent wisely and that it actually has an impact. And that is something we constantly study and pass legislation around. I think next year in the 25 session, legislators will hear a lot about some new methods to get people off of fentanyl that are kind of being developed nationwide. Two budget highlights I would mention that we did in the supplemental, and again, this is a supplemental budget, so it's not a large budget. The state runs roughly off $60 billion budget, and that's for 2 years. So we just kind of updated the budget, but we put $230 million new dollars into homelessness, and that will go a lot towards services. It goes towards renter-landlord programs that we've already established, works to keep people in their home. And then for people that are struggling to stay in their home, we're this year in calendar year 24, you'll see a lot of energy assistance for people that are in lower income and in homes. And then on the fentanyl front, putting $215 million new dollars, and a lot of that will go towards treatment. The state continues to invest there and evaluate and has had success in treatment. It's but it's hard to see those successes when we see so many people struggling in our neighborhoods, in our backyards. What I can tell you, though, are that it has been successful. We just need to keep fighting it. That money will also be used on outreach and prevention, but the vast majority of it will go into fentanyl. Good question, Susan. And you press *3. Thanks for doing that. And I'll just ask Guy, I believe when we typically do these town halls, if you press *3, you're going to talk to somebody and get your question answered, but then you'll be able to listen to the rest of the town hall while you're in the queue or until you get called up. So it's not like you won't be able to hear what we're saying if you choose to answer a question. So we encourage people to answer questions. We usually have quite a few, and so far tonight they've been great.
Exactly right. Exactly right. You'll still be in the town hall. Just stay on the line. Thank you so much for that answer, Senator, and thank you for that question. We have now a question. Press *3 again if you want to ask yours. We have a question from Katie about smaller fire stations being closed. Katie, go ahead. You're live.
Yes, good evening. My question is, over the last 5 or 10 years, the smaller fire stations on Lock Mountain Road, Blue Mountain Road, Diamond Point are being closed. Our fire insurance went from $1,500 a year to $4,000. Now they're sending out postcards asking for volunteer firefighters. Kevin knows well because he was a firefighter that the home down below in front of me in 2013 burnt to the ground. He was one of the firefighters there. And it seems to be that instead of increasing and hiring more firefighters, we're doing away with facilities and prevention. We seem to be right now, most of the firefighters that our country has throughout the United States are volunteered, not paid firefighters. We live in these areas that we all think are beautiful and wonderful, but as I understand now, they're building a bigger, better fire station in Carlsbad. But if you're 6 miles out from that fire station, our insurance rates and our reliable time for, you know, helping us with fires is even going to be harder. So where do you guys stand on getting our community more firefighters paid that will be here to help us when we need that call?
That's a great question. This is Kevin, and I'll go ahead and answer that. Since you're right, I still actually am a firefighter. I haven't left the fire department, and I'm in, and I do work for Fire District 3, which is Sequim and in the surrounding area, as you mentioned, and that fire district is in the process of shutting down the Lost Mountain Station. That actually won't have that big of effect on your insurance rating, because when insurance companies do their rating, they factor in a number of things and look at everybody's records. And in order for a station to count, it has to have a pretty active volunteer force, and Lost Mountain hasn't had that for a while. So for the people living there, as far as their insurance rates go, it shouldn't have an impact because that station hasn't had volunteers for a while. They're doing one last outreach to see if they can somehow drum up some volunteers. There's just not enough call volume there to have paid staff there. You mentioned the Diamond Point Fire Station. That is still open. It has very, very active and great volunteer force. And the R Corner Station that's at the bottom of Blue Mountain Road is still open and has an active volunteer force. The fire district continues to grow. They are expanding and hiring people, so I do credit them for that. And I think the mid-range plan, a few years out, I believe, is to start putting career staff at that R Corner Fire Station. So that will, I think, help with your ratings. But I understand your frustration. I mean, insurance companies have realized that if you live in a rural area that may or may not have a volunteer fire station and your house catches on fire, unfortunately, there's a high likelihood that it will be a significant fire and a high loss. And so they charge more for insurance costs, which I know is frustrating and worrisome. And the fire district is working as hard as they can to make sure to try to control those costs and use the tax money that they get to have as big an impact as possible on those costs.
Thank you so much for that answer, Senator, and thank you for that question. If you're listening, this is a live telephone town hall meeting with your 24th district lawmakers. Press *3 right now or any time during the call to ask your question. We have now a question from Janet about the homestead exemption for taxes. Janet, go ahead. You're live.
Hi, thanks for doing this. I appreciate that. And my question is, I recognize that you can't charge people a different tax rate on a primary residence than you do for a secondary or vacation residence, but I'm aware that some states have written into their homestead exemption laws, which Washington has the homestead exemption law, that essentially allows you to tax differently the home that's under the homestead exemption than a home that is not under the homestead exemption. And so potentially what that could do is provide a tax incentive for people not to have second homes, and it might relieve some of the housing crisis. Has anybody been talking about anything like that?
This is Representative Chapman. Yeah, there's been talk of exempting the first, maybe the first 200,000 of a home from taxation. And it really is being driven by a lot of folks out of the I-5 corridor where they're seeing a lot of their elderly being kind of taxed out of their home as their home values have skyrocketed, you know, 600,000, 700,000, 100,000, $1 million, $1.2 million. I know the Finance Committee looked at that issue. The problem is because so much of our public education is funded through property tax, it would drive a budget hole. We'd see massive cuts to public education, and so it's tricky. We do have the 1% property tax limitation still in place, so that local governments and state can only take 1% more per year, and that has certainly put a cap on the growth of property tax. Unfortunately, as house values have skyrocketed around the state, you know, people are paying more for property taxes as their values go up. But yeah, it has been looked at. It was sponsored by some I-5 corridor legislators who are really worried that a number of their elderly folks aren't going to be able to stay in their home. But again, it would just, it look, you know, the budget writers are like, yeah, we can't drive that big a hole in public education. And if you talk to the public education folks, and one could argue that, you know, that they can't take a cut. They're not, you know, in some areas we're not funding them enough as it is. So it's a tricky issue. I don't know, Steve or Kevin, if you guys know anything more than my limited comments.
Yeah, I mean, I totally understand what you're saying, Mike, and that is met with some concern. I think what she was specifically asking, I have not seen a proposal for around. So essentially what she was asking would be, it would make it not a tax penalty, but it would take away any tax benefits to having a second home, or it would, and I have not seen proposals around that personally.
I mean, property taxes for everyone on the call, you know, obviously people are concerned about their property taxes, but you know, please talk to your local educators, because I think that's where most of your property tax goes, to fund basic education, which is a paramount duty of the state of Washington. So it becomes, any adjustment to the how we tax property inevitably is going to hurt public education. And I think if you talk certainly around the 24th, we hear a lot from the school districts that feel like, you know, they need more help, not less. And that's the conundrum of trying to govern funding, you know, funding education through property tax. It's tricky, but we do have to fund basic education.
Yeah, this is Steve. And Mike, I think there's tax programs for seniors,
right.
Based on your income,
yeah,
where you can get a property tax reduction, not have to pay, you get a percentage reduction. And there has been talk of this homestead exemption, but I don't think it's gone anywhere, but we do sort of increase the value of that senior deduction. I think we did that last year, actually, to sort of adjust to the price of both taxes and the housing costs.
And we did, and my counterpoint, I mean, I voted for it. You know, we want to help seniors. I do want people to know that when a senior gets a property tax exemption or reduction, or even eliminate their property tax, that money is still collected. So it does shift the burden to our working families. And the exemption for the seniors now is higher than the average family wage for our working families in our district. So it doesn't come with, again, there is a cost for all of these programs. Somebody else's. So we're asking more from our working families, you know, who aren't as well off, maybe as some of our, but we're asking, you know, we're trying to help seniors. So again, I just want everyone to understand these are tricky, tricky issues. There's no easy answer, and it all, you know, kind of fits together. And I think, yeah.
Thank you all for those answers and that question. We are in a live telephone town hall meeting with the 24th District lawmakers and all the constituents. There's hundreds of folks who have participated so far, and we are about halfway through. Press *3 on your phone right now to ask a question of your local lawmakers. Now we have Carol with a question about wildlife and ocean shores. Carol, go ahead.
Yes, I live in Ocean Shores. I'm a resident here, and I see a lot of building like every place. And I'm kind of concerned about, has there been any thought for the deer and the raccoons, the wildlife here and the bears? People come here to enjoy the wildlife, but it doesn't seem to me like there's being much done to protect them as far as things to area to have food for them. Is this considered, or is there anything in the making for it to maybe?
Yeah, this is Steve. I don't know of any particular program up here in Port Townsend. We probably have, 400 or 500 deer walking around town. They're not very healthy, I'll say, because the ecosystem isn't really, you know, set up to support that many deer, but I don't think there's any specific, you know, policies to, in an area that's sort of like Ocean Shores, where there's parks and the beach, of course, and the repair and the, you know, the shoreline areas and the scrubs there between the beach and the property where wildlife can live. But usually those designations, you know, people either use come to the state to set aside an area for wildlife. But in an area like Ocean Shores, I haven't heard of any of those proposals.
I'll just add in, I mean, that was a great answer, Steve. I know Fish and Wildlife does work with cities to on this issue. The thing I would add is we've had for about three decades in the state of urban growth areas that was passed in the early 90s, and that encourages cities to develop in their boundaries to control kind of sprawl, to use a descriptive term. And so places like Ocean Shores that have room to grow, and states like Washington where, you know, we have good weather, we don't have 110 degree temperatures or hurricanes or really devastating wildfires yet. Hopefully that won't happen. People are going to continue to move to the state, and places like Ocean Shores are pretty attractive. So they have lots to grow in, and there will be continued to be development there. Steve's capital budget actually does fund quite a bit. I mean, the state, you know, buys land to set aside at times for wildlife, and that potentially could be a solution in and around Ocean Shores maybe in the future.
Thank you so much for those answers and that question. Press *3 on your phone right now or anytime to ask your question of your local lawmakers in the 24th District. We have James now with a question about biochar. James, go ahead. You're live.
Hello. I was really excited to hear about this production of biochar, and I was wondering what the end result of it was. Was it going to go towards farming land? I heard somewhat about water. What would be that ending goal for that funding?
So it was not a money issue. It was an issue with there are a lot of small forest landowners that are interested in starting to do biochar, and the State Department of Ecology was giving them headaches and was not issuing permits for it. And so the legislation essentially, you know, forces or gives a path, I guess, for ecology to issue their permits. And these are kind of small portable biochar facilities. That's what the goal is. That's what these folks are interested in. And it's really a statewide effort. And so those will start being permitted by ecology, which is really the first step. And I think this will get off the ground quickly. What those landowners do with that biochar is up to them, but there's pretty consistent market for it. One of the more exciting things for biochar is if you're a farmer and you put it in your field, it retains water really well, and you need to use less water to irrigate, which benefits them. It benefits the rivers and the fish that rely on the rivers and all of us that need water out of those uses as well to survive. So it's proven to be really beneficial. And I think, you know, beyond this, it'll be a few years probably before the state needs to do anything. I think, like I said, these programs are going to take off because there is an interest in doing this, and we'll let the market take care of itself.
James, this is Steve. We put some money in the capital budget to help develop an energy plan for a company called Mino that is building a fairly large biochar plant west of Port Angeles. And the advantages, as Kevin mentioned, with the biochar is it helps retain moisture, but it also limits on agricultural land, limits the number of pesticides you have to use because the water retention and the biochar sort of helps maintain that system so you don't need as many quantities. And the other thing for having a larger plant in Port Angeles, I mean, there are companies, I think Interfor actually has to truck its sawdust to Canada. And so they can use that sawdust at this biochar plant, and all the slash that you see built up along the roadways here on the North Peninsula can go to that plant. So it removes the, you know, the risk of that fire, and it takes this sort of waste product and turns it into a valuable biochar product. And the other, it has other uses. It can be used for water for purification and as well as water retention. So it's a pretty exciting new area of investment for those of us on the peninsula.
Thank you so much for those answers and that question. Now we have a question from Darlene aimed at the senator. Darlene, go ahead. You're live.
Hi, Kevin. I want to thank you for your years of service. At this point, you're leaving that position. So are you available for the rest of the year for constituents to contact you, or what is the situation now in terms of senator?
Yeah, Darlene, good question. Thank you. Good to hear from you. For everybody else, as Darlene mentioned, I'm wrapping up my last year here as your legislator. I've served the Olympic Peninsula in the 24th Legislative District for 18 years, all very pleasurable. So my last year in the Senate, I'm running for a statewide office. And so to answer your question, Darlene, yes, I am in office until the end of this year. And none of my contact information changed. Our office is open. All the phone numbers are still available. My email is still available. If you go to my website, my cell phone number's on it, and feel free to reach out whatever way is most convenient for you or for the person, and I'll work and my office will work to get you an answer and solution. But, yes, I am finishing up my last session, but here for the remainder of this year to still serve as a state senator. And Mike Chapman, I'll just mention Mike Chapman is running for the Senate seat, and there's a few people looking to run for his open House seat.
Thank you, Darlene, for that question and those answers. Now we have Mary, who has a question about lottery funds. Mary, go ahead. You're live.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I have a question. Originally, when the citizens of Washington State voted to allow the lottery, 100% of the proceeds were supposed to go to the schools. And now the lawmakers are not allowing an independent audit of the funds. Where is the money going?
The money does go to the schools. This is Kevin. I'll answer that. I don't know about the audit that you're referring to. So as I mentioned earlier, and these are really rough numbers, right now the state's working on about a $60 billion biennial budget. So if you pare that down to 1 year, $30 billion, roughly we spend just over half of that money on public education. So it's about $17 billion. After you take out the expenses and the cost of the lottery, it generates about $100 million a year. So all of it does go to public education. It just is it's important to have that money, but it's $100 million in a $17 billion annual public school budget. It doesn't by any means fund all of it. As far as the audit goes, I don't know specifically what and I have not heard of that. We have a very robust auditing system in the state, and I think lottery typically gets pretty good reviews. I don't know if Mike or Steve have anything to add to that.
Well, this is
no,
Mike.
I would just agree, Kevin.
Go ahead.
I think that I'm sure that data is available. I have not heard of an audit either, but that data is available on the website at Access Washington or any fiscal. If you peel through there and look at the budget and the fiscal reporting, it'd be pretty transparent.
Yeah, and we have a state auditor that's, she's elected. There's been no piece of legislation that we voted on that says we can't audit anything. I mean, and the state auditor wouldn't probably, she's responsible. I think it's also important to remember that lottery, from what I understand, has been pretty stagnant for quite a while. There's really only a certain portion of the public that participates, so it's not a growth engine, and it doesn't does generate, like Kevin said, $100 million is a lot of money, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not making a difference. So I don't know that we want to encourage people to participate in the lotto, but if they do, they can rest assured that if they don't win, their money goes to public education. But it's kind of I've always had a real hard time with that one, that we're asking people to gamble to pay for public education. So
thank you so much for those answers and that question. This is a live telephone town hall meeting. Press *3 to ask your question. We now have a question from Leanne about disasters. Leanne, go ahead. You're live. Leanne, are you there? I don't think we have Leanne. We're going to go to the next question, which is Bonita, about a Rainier cleanup. Bonita, go ahead.
Hi, this is Bonita Barton from Port Angeles. The Rainier cleanup remains stalled. Is there any hope that something will happen with the Department of Ecology or the Environmental Protection Agency before the 2025 session?
This is Steve. I don't think so. There was a great article actually in the Peninsula Daily News, I don't know, a week or so ago. Papers stack up when I'm in Olympia, and so I read a bunch of them, so I can't remember what the exact date was, but they did a pretty good analysis of the issue. Part of the challenge is that Rainier Properties, and it used to be Rainier as a corporation, owned the mill and operated the mill, and then a few years back, about a decade or so ago, they separated out. So there's sort of the Rainier Properties, and then there's the ongoing, corporation of Rainier. The properties group is dealing with the cleanup, and there's a lot of discussion about what the boundaries have been decided, but then what is the level of cleanup and what the what those costs are going to be. So I think that's the hang up, and it is frustrating because it's been probably 20 years now that project's been going on, but there is progress being made, but it's very slow, and it's partly the negotiations between the Department of Ecology and Rainier Properties.
Thank you so much for that question and that answer. We have a question now from Ernest about car accidents and car insurance. Ernest, go ahead. You're live.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. I ran my idea by a lot of people, and everybody thought it was a great idea. No one could see a hole in it. So I'm going to ask you what you think about people who are driving recklessly, increasing the mandatory deductible on liability insurance policies. So people could wind up hopefully paying less for their car insurance. The car insurance companies would have less cost, and there'd be less tragedy and waste with all the car accidents we have here in our state. Many people have said that if they didn't have insurance, they would probably drive more carefully. And I suspect it's unfortunate that people don't value their own lives as much as they value their wallets. But as far as passing any kind of legislation, it's kind of like a user fee in a way. The people that are causing most of the problems are basically paying no more for their insurance than people who drive carefully. My question is, could this be run by the insurance commissioner? Could this be legislated where people would pay a much higher deductible if they were the cause of an accident?
I serve on the committee that oversees those issues, the Consumer Protection and Business Committee. And I know one thing, the insurance companies would love to have a mandatory, they would love to require you to show your insurance when you get your car tabs. And there has been a look at legislation along those lines, but it hasn't gotten off the ground. The insurance companies are frustrated that there are a lot of uninsured drivers. I think when you get back to the speed issue, I'm hoping that with some of the reforms we just adopted around policing and the ability for them to make contact, that, you know, we'll start seeing more and more people pulled over for excessive speed. And there's some other safety projects. There'll be some speed safety cameras in construction zones, and so people are going to have to learn to slow down. Mandatory legislation, though, and around deductibles, you know, it always gets tricky because we try to live, you know, try to govern in a way that gives people freedom of choice. And the insurance companies, you can certainly have a higher deductible and pay a less amount. But basically, we just come down to so many people can't afford insurance and don't have it. But I'd like to think that a lot of those folks are also the ones that are speeding. And I'm hoping that we'll see more and more speed enforcement occurring on our roads. We've tried to beef that up. We did pass a bill to encourage so the State Patrol is down. They're having a hard time making recruiting numbers. And so now we're going to be giving longevity bonuses to troopers to keep them on the job while we try to backfill the 200 to 300 open trooper positions. And if you know anybody who wants to be a trooper or a police officer or a county sheriff, this is a great time to get into law enforcement for people that maybe know a younger person who's interested. There are openings everywhere. And part of it is we just don't have as many officers on the street, especially on the State Patrol side. So we did pass longevity bonuses and with the expectation that they're going to make more stops. Also the speed traffic cameras. If you go zipping through a construction zone on a state highway, you're very likely going to be getting a sizable infraction in the mail. So everybody needs to slow down when we see these construction zones all over. You're going to have to slow down, folks. And that's, you know, we've got to educate people that these aren't NASCAR tracks, they're state highways.
Thank you kindly for that question and that answer. We have Judith now, who has a question about saving the oldest house in Clallam County. Judith, go ahead. You're live.
Hi, guys. You probably all seen me. I'm from the Squim Museum. We have the oldest stick-built house in Clallam County sitting on our property. We are trying to renovate it to use it as a classroom for our makers lab. What can the state do to help us?
Yeah, great to hear from you, Judy. As you know, there's the Capital Heritage account, which is open right now, I think, for applications. And you can look at that on the website through the Historical Society and find that application. And then the Historical Society vets those projects and then gives us a list that we will fund next year in the biennial budget. And so that's probably your best pathway. We did have a house that someone brought to us at the Capital Budget from down in the 19th, down in Wakayakum. It was the Julie Butler house. Julie Butler happened to be one of the first congresswomen in the country and a committee person. And they wanted us to purchase that house and put it into the state park system. We weren't able to do that because it's really expensive to maintain and staff, but we're having actually the Historical Society take a look at it and see how we can move forward. But I would get in touch with the Historical Society. That'd be the best way to do it.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for that answer and that question. That is as many questions as we have time to do right now. If you asked a question and it was not answered, please stay on the line and leave a voicemail so lawmakers can get back to you to answer your specific question. I'm now going to pass it over to your three local lawmakers for closing remarks. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
I can kick us off here. This is Kevin. Just wanted to thank everybody again for getting on this call and listening to us and asking us questions. As Guy mentioned, if you email us or record your question, we do get back to all those. It does take staff a few days. I also should mention, I didn't mention earlier when I was answering Darlene's question, my LA has gone to the campaign side with me, so Don Thomas, who is Steve's legislative aide, works in his office, is helping out my office. So she might be responding if you guys reach out to on questions. Again, it's been a great pleasure serving everyone for the last 18 years, and I'll kick it over to Steve.
Thanks, Kevin, and this is probably your last Teletown Hall, so it's been great serving with you. I think we've had a great team. I've learned a lot from you, and we've I think, managed the district's issues pretty well between the Senate and the House, and good luck to you in your future plans. And as Kevin mentioned, Dawn Thomas, she's great. She's my LA. She's going to handle both Kevin's office and my office. She's got a lot of experience. She used to be the LA for Brian, folks from O'Brien Blake down in the 19th, and then she's worked in the Senate for a year. So she's really qualified. She's great, and don't hesitate to get in touch with her if you have issues for either, you know, Kevin or myself or even Mike. We work very very much as a team for the 24th District. During the interim, you know, we are a citizen legislature, but we're pretty busy all year round. And if you have a group that you want us to meet with or issues, don't hesitate to get in touch with our offices, and we'll be more than happy to schedule something. Be patient, though, because our calendars are pretty busy. So thanks for being on the call, everybody, and thanks for your good questions. And Guy, thank you. You do a great job as an MC there.
Yeah, really, I agree with Steve. And especially this is Mike. Again, I want to thank Kevin for his service. I believe he served 10 years in the House and now 8 years in the Senate, and then as a firefighter in Squim. And, you know, I hope folks folks may agree with this, you may not agree, but I do want to just put on the record, like I said at the very beginning, the three of us work really hard and communicate. And, you know, that probably isn't the case in every legislative district between the House and the Senate members. So we've worked really hard, and I think we've made a good team. Obviously, the voters are going to have some new choices and some new members to look at, you know, new options this year, later this year. But for now, I think, you know, we're off and running, and we're having meetings, and we're around the district, and we're kind of listening to some of the issues we didn't get addressed that need to be addressed for next year. And then obviously the second half of the year, you know, we'll start hearing about budget requests and budget issues. I just want to put on the record that, you know, you have a lot of hardworking folks around the district, both in county and local government. And I always feel like we have really good partnerships, representing basically three, you know, all of Clallam, all of Jefferson, and really about 80% of Grays Harbor now, land size and the majority of the population. You know, the partnerships between our local government friends and those of us in the legislature are really important. So I always like to give a shout out to all of the hardworking and dedicated public servants and serving all of us, especially, you know, thank your road crew when you see them out, or thank your power crew, or thank your firefighter, or your police officer, and even the, you know, the folks behind the counter in the courthouses and the city hall. So, and your school directors and your teachers and all of, you know, all the folks that make living on the peninsula such a great place. I think Steve, Kevin, and I just try to add something, but boy, the day-to-day work is occurring even you know, in every county and in every community. So it's a beautiful place to live. We all love it. And, you know, it's kind of being loved to death these days, but, you know, and this summer, everybody, please be safe out there on the highways, most definitely. So thanks for everyone for listening in.